Much, Mr. Petrie. If you'd like to title your sermon today, I'd like to title this one, Building Godly Families. And I want it to be part and parcel with what we just did today. We asked God to put his angels around Abigail. Why would we do that? Why would God care? And why would we put angels around Abigail? You know, all babies start out as sweet, innocent bundles of joy. That does not include 2 a.m. feedings or temper tantrums, but most of the time, they are sweet little bundles of joy. But we all have seen the world that we bring these children up in and how pretty precarious it can be. And so we ask God to protect our children when we can't. We will do the best that we can, and we're going to talk about that today. How do we do our job the best that we can to help bring Abigail up as a fine young lady? But when we can't, and we can't always be there, then the rest of it goes to God, and we ask him to protect our young ones through his holy angels. So what can we do as parents to help Abigail? What can we do as grandparents? What can we do as siblings, cousins, aunts, uncles, the church? What can we do to prepare Abigail for this world? You know, there are a lot of things in life that children learn, and the majority of those things they learn at home. So let's talk about some of the things that a child learns at home. They learn how to feed themselves. Our daughter posted a video of saying, I think Grandpa's going to get his wish. He may have a left-handed granddaughter. Because she would put a spoon with some food on it, and Eliana, every time, would grab it with her left hand, even though she put it right in the middle. So there's hope that Grandpa will get. I've been praying about that. But you have to teach them how to eat. Otherwise, they would never know. They would just always use their fingers. You have to teach them when sleep time is. I don't know what it is about babies, but they always want to be up at night and sleep during the daytime. And you've got to teach them when to sleep and when to stay awake. Potty training, oh boy, tough time. How about how to communicate with words? Instead of grunting, you say, no. At some point in time, you say, no. If you want that cracker, you've got to say, Dad, I want a cracker, please. And if they don't say please, they don't get it either. They've got to vocalize. They've got to use words. And you teach them that at home. When they start to read, I remember the very first day that I realized that our daughter was starting to read. And I don't remember how old she was, probably 4 or 5, something like that. But I heard her in the back seat. We're driving down the road, and she goes, stop, stop, stop. That sign said stop. And she was sounding it out. And then I thought, okay, note to self, let's start getting books out. We're gonna teach her to read. And she started reading. Remember that? For those of you that have had kids, or for those of you that are kids, do you remember the first books that you read? I was heavy into Hardy Boys and all of those things, the readers that we had as a child. Those are things that you learn, and you learn them at home. So a lot of things in life are learned at home, but included free of charge in this life are outside influences. And as parents, you have very little impact over that, it seems. When a child goes to school, they all of a sudden come home with a brand new vocabulary. Words, phrases, thoughts that you didn't teach them. Where did all of this come from? Outside influence. Entertainment. Watching television or going to a movie or whatever. Thankfully, we have remote controls with mute buttons so that when inappropriate commercials come on, you can hit the mute button real fast and hope that they didn't hear anything. Every time I counsel people for marriage, I always tell them, don't let Hollywood ruin your marriage. If you look at the way Hollywood portrays marriage, you will get it all wrong. That is just not the place to get that. You get that from your parents. You get it from home. You get it from teaching. But yet, free of charge, that outside influence is going to be there. Social media. There wasn't even such a thing as social media when I was a kid. And we didn't have that. Social media would have been writing a note and passing it during class when you weren't supposed to. That was about as close as we got to social media. That's a huge influence on kids now. I tell this story. I told it this morning in Laurel. we have a social media director for the church, Kelly Hogg. Went to camp this year, and one of the questions that she asked the girls in 2G said, what social app do you use? And in her mind, she was assuming that everybody would say Facebook. How many of you use Facebook? About four or five hands went up, was all, including mine. And I think now Facebook's kind of an old person thing. They've got new things now. They've got other things that they get to because social media is evolving. It's very hard to keep control of that. If you don't think your kids pick up on their environment, plop them down in front of a television with a boring movie where they're not paying attention, and then as soon as a commercial comes on, they are riveted to the television. You know why? Because commercials are louder than the rest. I'll talk about that in just a second. They're more colorful. There's lots of flash and glitz, and it catches their attention. And they see it and they listen. I actually looked it up as to why commercials are louder. You know why? Obviously, they want their product to be known, but the FCC actually tells them they can't do that. The average volume can't be any higher than the average volume of the television program. So what they do is they have five, out of a 30-second spot, they'll have 5 or 7 seconds of silence so that they can then have the stuff that they're actually saying a lot louder, and the average isn't any different than the program, but they're speaking and the glitz and all of that and the music is. The FCC is actually looking into it right now to try and limit that to where they can't do that anymore. Or if you don't think they pick up on their environment, see when they repeat an ill-spoken word that they heard from someone else and then they won't stop repeating it. It's awful how kids can do that, where they can be listening to some show on television and the one word that you don't want them to pick up is the one word that, and maybe they just see your reaction to it and think, oh, Mom got a reaction. I better learn that word. Even cute examples. I saw one on Facebook this year. I didn't realize this was happening, but in the last sermon that I gave at the feast, I said, now, we've been here for 8 days. We've been having a lot of fun. And now we got to go back to school, we got to go back to work, we got to go back to our lives. And sometimes when you go back, you can feel deflated. That was the word I used. This little 3-year-old, I sort of popped up, went up to her mom and said, Mom, I feel deflated. The kid doesn't even know what that word means. So the mom just kind of passed it off. But the next day on the way home, the kid said, yeah, I'm deflated. And that's his new favorite word. And I was thankful that that was the word I chose to use in the sermon and not something else, because that's what he picked up on. I tell this story on Doug Horchek, for those of you that know him. He and Tanya Horchek had their, and I think at the time he was probably their 4 or 5-year-old grandson in the car. And all of a sudden, the grandson pops up and says, Grandpa, what year were you born? And he told him. And his eyes got real big and he said, Grandpa, you're a 19er. Meaning born in the 1900s instead of the 2000s, like all of the kids. You're a 19er. I don't even know how he found that word at age 4 or 5, but they're thinking. They grow, they think, they learn. Let me ask you a couple of questions here in the rest of the sermon today. At what age should you start to prepare yourselves to be a good parent? At what age? When should you start? Well, you know what? For a lot of people, it's, uh-oh, we're pregnant. I better start preparing to be a parent. It's not the right time. What is the job of a parent versus the job of a grandparent? Oh, now I'm going to be getting on dangerous territory here. We're going to talk about that today because I am one. So I see things that I didn't see before. Can an older sibling influence a younger sibling? These are important questions to face with the task of raising Abigail. Because she's going to be in our midst for a long, long time, we hope. And as a process, we need to be making sure that we're doing what we can as parents, as grandparents, as family, as siblings, as cousins and aunts and uncles. What can we do to help her grow? You know, there's no greater influence on children in a very young age than their family. I want to talk a little bit about that today. The influence of the family will greatly shape their future when they're extremely young. Everybody knows that children learn great things when they're at home. and it will greatly shape their future. It will have an impact on how they do at school, how they do at work, even in marriage. Every parent starts with the hope that their child will turn out well and make absolutely no mistakes. And every parent will have success stories, and every parent will have regrets. That's how it works. There's nothing you can do about it. It's going to happen. But how can you maximize successes, and how can you minimize regrets? I want to actually talk about all the different sectors in this room. Parents, grandparents, siblings, aunts, uncles, church friends, older teens, older young adults. How can we help Abigail? Brethren, it starts by building our lives first and then their lives on a moral foundation. You will be a rotten teacher of morality if you're not a moral person yourself. So I want to encourage all of us today to be building our lives on a moral foundation so that we can be a good example to Abigail and to all of the other children that will come and go. You may not realize it, but the time to start preparing yourself for having children is long before you ever get married. In fact, it should be in your early teens when you start taking control of your life and you start realizing, hey, you know what? I'm becoming an adult. I need to start acting like one. At Family Day, something happened. There were two boys that were playing Jenga. Thanks to the Gutierrez for that. Great success. So they're playing this game, and one boy is, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9, and the other boy was probably 14 or 15, maybe a little older, I don't know. And I was amazed. I sat there and watched that, and do you know what Jenga is? You know what I'm talking about? It's blocks that are, you know, maybe it's a big game, tall game. It's maybe an 8-inch block by 2 inches wide by an inch tall or whatever, and you set them like in a lattice work, and then you pull out various ones, and you pull something out from the middle, then you set it on top. And as you pull it out, it gets more holy like Swiss cheese, and it starts to totter. And the idea of the game is to be the one that doesn't cause it to fall over. And they had this thing going so tall, and it was so shaky, I just knew at any moment it was going to fall. And yet, for the next 10 minutes, they kept stacking stuff up. And I asked the older boy, I said, how is it that you keep this thing from falling down? And he didn't even look at me. He was so intent. But his answer was not only simple, but amazing. He said, it has a stable foundation. And I looked down at the bottom two rows, and they hadn't touched those. Both of them were smart enough to know that if they goofed around with the foundation, the whole thing would fall. So they left the bottom two rows alone and started on row 3 and were playing this game of Jenga. How can we have a stable or a moral foundation? I'd like to start with this concept and then build on it. Let's turn to Psalm chapter 89 to start with. Psalm chapter 89. And let's read starting in verse 11. This is talking about God and his greatness. Do you want to be great? Everybody does. We talked about that. Disciples wanted to be great. There's nothing wrong with being great. It's just not wanting to be greater than everybody else. But do you want to be great? This is talking about God's greatness. Notice what it says that he is capable of doing. Verse 11 of Psalm 89. The heavens are yours. The earth is yours. He created the entire expanse of the universe, the world in all its fullness, for you have founded them. The north and the south, you have created him. You know what I like to think of when I read that? That he created gravity and he created magnetism. You realize if we didn't have magnetism, we wouldn't have north and south. We wouldn't have the polarity of the earth. Some people don't realize this, but because we have a molten core, here goes the science nerd coming out, sorry guys, the molten core and that the earth is spinning, that creates a magnetic field. And when radiation from the sun hits the Van Allen belts, the magnetic field, the most of the bad elements of radiation are pulled toward the poles, so they hit the north and the south pole where there's very little people. And that's why you have the northern lights. It's all this garbage, if you want to call it, that's being pulled into the north and the south pole that protects the earth. He creates, as it says here, the north and the south he created. He created magnetism. He created gravity. Tabor and Hermon rejoice in your name. Those are mountains. Imagine the power it takes to build a mountain. You have to have tectonic plates. You have to have lava and the magma that's in the center of the earth, it's always churning around. That's how mountains are built. Verse 13, you have a mighty arm, and strong as your hand, and high as your right hand. Isn't that what we want for all of our kids? We want them to be strong. We want them to be fearless. We want them to be everything that they can possibly be. What a great thing. That's what God is. But notice how it started. Verse 14, righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. What's God's foundation? Before he ever started to create anything, he had righteousness and he had justice as his foundation, morality. He was, by his very nature, a moral being. And when he did his creation, he did it from a foundation of morality, a foundation of righteousness and justice. Before he ever built the universe, before he ever started to build his family, he built it upon the basis of righteousness and justice. And it's on that basis that I want to build the rest of the sermon today. Our foundation, before we have children, should be to learn righteousness and justice. And that starts long before marriage. That should start when you're actually quite young. Let's now go to Luke chapter 6. This is where we talk about building a house on a good foundation. But I wanted to mention that as a precursor, that what we're talking about here is the foundation needs to be a moral lifestyle, a lifestyle like God and like Jesus Christ. Luke chapter 6 and verse 46. Luke chapter 6 and verse 46. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? I think it's true. It can be as true in this church or as in any church. There are people who say that they're converted, say that they're religious, say that they follow Jesus Christ, but they don't do what he says. They may say it, but they don't do it. You can call on the name of Jesus, but not do what he says. So notice what he says in verse 7. Because there's a three-part element to verse 47. Whoever comes to me, whoever hears my sayings, and whoever does them, I will show you what he's like. So someone that comes to the teachings of Jesus Christ, listens to the teachings of Jesus Christ, and then does the teachings of Jesus Christ. What is that person like? That you talk about having a moral foundation. You have heard what your Creator has said, you have listened to it, and you apply what he says. That's having a moral foundation. Verse 48, he's like a man who built a house and who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. I think most of us today probably have, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of us have a house that's built on a slab. Our very first house was Pier and Beam. And when I got under it and looked at it, and this was in Southern California where we had, literally in Pasadena, California, we had over 300 earthquakes a year. Now, they weren't big ones, but they were, it was almost one earthquake a day. And that house had rocks that were, oh, maybe half the size of this podium. And then they were set on the foundation, the rock of the foundation of the earth. And then on that rock was just the 4x4 post. And there were 15 or 20 of them around, and the house never moved. Why? Because those rocks were set on foundation rock. And it wasn't going anywhere unless, of course, the rocks cracked. And that's what God is saying here. For someone who listens to my saying and does them, it's like a person who dug deep and laid his foundation on bedrock, on that stone of the earth. So that when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently, or I might add, when the earthquakes came, the house, on the house, it could not shake it, for it was founded on a rock. Our foundation, the very things that he wants us to be building our lives on in adulthood, should be based on a solid foundation. If we don't, verse 49, but he who heard but did nothing is like a man who built a house and just set his foundation on the earth. I actually saw a house built one time like that. It was a friend of mine that built a house, and he thought, well, I don't need to put any prep work into this. I'll just lay this really good floor, and then I'll just build on top of that. And after you put tons and tons of weight of the house started to sink. And there was he lost the entire structure because he didn't have a solid foundation. He just laid it on the dirt, which, you know, you jump up and down on the earth, you think, this is pretty solid. But after a house and then after, you know, rains and stuff that come, it started to shift and he lost his house. and the stream beat against it vehemently, and immediately it fell. If we start adulthood with a solid foundation, our ability to withstand life's trials will be spared. And that's what we want for Abigail. It's what we want for all of us. We want to teach her. We want ourselves to be taught to have a solid foundation so that when, not if, trials happen, we'll be ready for them. And we can do what we can to make sure that we enter adulthood with that solid foundation. It has to go beyond reading. It has to go beyond hearing. It must be built on a solid rock. And what rock are we talking about in here? We're talking about obedience to what God says. And again, that starts when you reach the level of maturity that you can decide for yourselves what path you'll take. Luke 6 is talking as much to teenagers as it is to adults. We all need to be preparing ourselves, and we need to be putting our life on a solid foundation. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. This is a similar thought, but it uses a little different analogy. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and I want to start in verse 9. First Corinthians 3, verse 9. It says, "For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, and you are God's building." You know, you think about the fact that God created the universe, he created the earth. He's the master builder. If you were to ever build a building, who would you want to help you build the building but the guy who created everything, right? Wouldn't it be great to get, we've remodeled a bunch of homes in our lives, and when I got to the place where I didn't know what I was doing, I went and got help, someone that knew what they were doing. God is building a building. Verse 10, "According to the grace of God, which was given to me, Paul, as a wise master builder, I laid the foundation and another built on it." I want to just briefly describe what he's talking about there. Paul would go from city to city to city, and he would go into the synagogue, and he would preach about Jesus Christ and about the Messiah, and some people would come to him, and he would start a local church congregation in all of the cities. But he didn't stay there. He started it, maybe stayed there for a year or two, and then he would go on to the next city, and then he would leave deacons and elders in charge. And then they would be responsible to go from there. So again, "I laid the foundation and another built upon it." I started, you know, the church in Thessalonica, and I then set up deacons and elders, and they then had to manage the church. Verse 11, "For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ." In this analogy, Jesus Christ is the foundation, and we should build our house on him. And this is a very interesting analogy, because we're going to talk about taking something that is absolutely perfect, the foundation of Jesus Christ, and then building on it wisely or building on it in an unwise manner. Verse 12, "Now if anyone builds on this foundation, on Jesus Christ," we're not talking about building on a foundation now, we're talking about the best foundation in the universe. "If you build on that foundation with gold and silver and precious stones," those are all good things, "or wood, hay, and straw," not so good things. If you build a house out of straw, it's not going to last very long, especially when the rains come or when the big bad wolves come. "Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or straw, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it. It will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is." Fire. There will be trials that will come and beat against your house. If you've built your house out of gold and precious stones and good things, then it's going to withstand. But if you build it out of hay or straw, it's not going to do so well. And what God is telling us is we all have the same foundation. We all have the truth of Jesus Christ. But on that foundation, we can still build a lousy house, and it can end up falling down because all of us will be tried. Verse 14, "If anyone's work which he has built endures, then you used good construction material, and you will receive your reward. But if anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet as though through fire." What's he talking about? We are given trials on purpose. If we build a house bad, or let's say we build part of the house good, and then we get lazy and start building some other part of our character not so good, guess what? Fire comes along and burns that section of your house down. What do? You rebuild. Hopefully this time you rebuild with better materials. You continue to learn, you continue to grow, and those trials in life, which none of us like, Abigail's going to go through trials. She's not going to like them. She's going to do things her parents are not going to like them. That's a part of it. But she's going to learn from them. And we want her to learn from them. And we want her to be able to grow. We want her parents to be able to learn and to grow. That's what it is that God wants. He wants us, in this analogy, to grow as we build upon his foundation. We are all responsible for building upon the foundation of Jesus Christ. I want you to notice, again, teens, I know I'm picking on you a lot. I do that a lot, but it's because I really like you guys. I want you to recognize what I said. You need to build your foundation on Jesus Christ. I did not say build your foundation on your parents or their belief. I did not say build your foundation on the Church of God, a worldwide association. It's not the point. The point is you build your foundation on Jesus Christ. You follow his teachings. I'm going to give a couple of scriptures here that should sound familiar because I talked about this at Camp Carter some. That is a big responsibility. You have to build your own building, and you have to build it on the teachings of Jesus Christ. Your parents can't do that for you. At some point in time, Abigail is going to reach the age where she has to start doing this on her own. Now, AJ and Reed are going to do their best to get her there. So is the rest of the family. So are the rest of us. So are even Emma, at some point in time, is going to say, I need to be a better big sister. And it's going to make sense to her as she reaches that age. It's a big responsibility, but that's what we have to do. If you are successful at it, the rest of your life will be much easier because the trials that will come, you will be able to successfully circumnavigate because you've built successfully. I wanted to use two scriptures on this. Psalm 127. Psalm 127. And I want to start in verse 1, and I'd like for you to notice the order. I want to read verses 1 through 5, and I want you to notice the order that God places this in, because he's going to talk about having kids here, but there's something that happens before you have kids. Psalm 127 and verse 1. Unless the Eternal builds your house, you're going to labor in vain if you try and build it. Unless you build it on God's foundation and unless you build it according to his purposes, you may try and build a house, but if you don't know how to build it, if you don't do it according to code, if you want to use some modern terminology, it could fall down, it could burn to the ground, or it could flood because you haven't built it right. Again, why wouldn't you want the creator of the universe being one to help you build your building? Unless the Eternal builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Eternal guards the city, or I might say, unless the Eternal guards your home, the watchman stays awake in vain. Have you ever had that happen where you were up all night because you were fearful of something? Marlis and I came home from the feast once and our house got robbed. I didn't sleep that night. I was up all night long. Even though I knew those robbers were probably nowhere near, I didn't sleep a wink that night, right? Because I was fearful. My house that I thought was safe got broken into. Verse 2, it is in vain for you to rise up early or to sit up late and to eat the bread of sorrows, but he gives his beloved sleep. If God is involved in your building, it's going to have the best alarm system. It's going to be built the best way, and it will withstand whatever trials come. And you can lay down and you can go to sleep at night knowing that you've built your house, you've built your life, you've built your moral foundation on strong character and on the ways of Jesus Christ so that you will be successful in life, in marriage, in career, and ultimately in parenting. Then he gets to verse 3. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. Now notice verse 3 didn't precede verse 1 and 2. You build the house first. Again, that should sound familiar. We're going to go to the scripture that I used during Camp Carter when I did the Christian living. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. I want to kind of dissect that for a minute and see what that means. Children are something that God gives to you, parents, to AJ and to Rita. God gave you Emma and Abigail. You may think, no, we did this. Yeah, good luck with that. God created the way for you guys to have kids. He gave you a heritage. It's his kids, and he granted them to you to raise into adulthood. That's your job. Ultimately, he wants them in his kingdom as his children, but he gave them to you to raise. That's your job right now. Behold, children are a heritage from the eternal, and the fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has a quiver full. Now, a quiver, by the way, is 12 to 14 arrows. I do not suggest, AJ, that you have 12 to 14 kids. You can if you want. Rita's shaking her head no. We stopped at two, and that was plenty. King David had ultimate money and a lot of people to help him, so he had a lot of kids. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that for us today. Happy is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed, but will speak with their enemies in the gates. Children are a great blessing. They're an exciting thing to have. God is giving them to you so that you can raise them. And when you raise them correctly to maturity, they will have direct access, just like you do, to the throne of God. What a great blessing. Let's turn also to Proverbs 24, verse 27. This is the verse that I used for the entirety of the Christian Living sermon that I gave at camp this year. Proverbs 24 and verse 27. Again, those at Camp Carter will remember this. It says, prepare your outside work and make it fit for yourself in the field, and afterward build your house. You need to make sure that you've got the ability to make a living, that you're mature enough to handle marriage, that you've got all of that set up before you build your house. So if you put it in order, before having children, you need to have a solid marriage. Before having a solid marriage, you need to have a solid foundation of moral, godly character. Don't get married until you have set your character on the right path, or it will cause problems later on. Don't have children until you have a solid marriage. One builds upon another. For the rest of the sermon today, and this is the last scripture that I want to go to, I want to deep dive into a single verse. I'd like to turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6, and I want to read verse 4, and then we're going to take the rest of the sermon, however long it takes, another half hour, 40 minutes, to talk about just this one verse itself. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. I want to read this all, and then we'll go back and dissect it. And you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. Now, I could have gone back to verse 1 and said, children, obey your parents. That's not the focus of this sermon today. That'll be the focus of another sermon that I do later on, so you kids can be ready for that. This is a focus on all of us. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. I would like to go through word for word what the Greek means here so that we can get a better understanding of the depth of what this verse says. In one sense, you might look at this and say, well, what this is saying is dads, not moms, dads, don't tick your kids off to where they get irritated at you because that's not going to help them out. Well, why would Paul say that? Well, sometimes dads can be a little tougher than moms. Moms can sometimes be the sweet one of the family, and dads can be the tough one. I promise you, every time I did something wrong, what came out of my mom's mouth was, wait till dad comes home. That was the last thing I wanted to hear. I would much rather mom deal with it than having dad come home. Fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. That's an easy kind of summation of this. Don't tick your kids off. That's not what this means, though. Let's go through this. The first word that I want to talk about here is father. The Greek word pater, or it's plural here, pateros. It is used primarily to refer to the man that is that directly applies to parenting, in other words, the husband and father, and he should rightly be the one that's in charge of the household. But the Greek word also carries some additional concepts, which gives this a much deeper meaning. Similar in English, we can do this in English too. The word father can refer to parents, both parents. In this case, in the Greek, pateros can mean both mother and father. It also can refer to the nearest ancestor. So that could be an aunt or an uncle. It could be the grandparents, right? The nearest relative. It also could refer to the father of the family. Think about when it said our father Abraham or the children of Israel. So the father would be the one that kind of caused this brood to come about. And maybe Bobby Weber, for the half of this audience in here, would be the the pater, right? The one that was responsible for all of this. It can refer again to parents, grandparents, the one who started the lineage. But it also can refer to anyone who has advanced in years. So what I want to do today is take a little bit of time as we go through this to talk about those various things. How does a parent apply this? How does a grandparent apply this? How does a big sister or an aunt or an uncle or a cousin apply this? How do our church family apply this? How can we be a father figure to Abigail? How can we do this? With all those meanings, who is responsible for the care of a child? I actually just sat down to think about this, and I wanted to kind of put this in order. I know I may step on some toes here, but I think it's important to say this. If you think about the order of who is responsible for Abigail, first and foremost, it's our Heavenly Father. As we saw in Psalm 127, He was the one that created the ability for her to be born, and He gave her to AJ and Rita. Ultimately, He is the one that's responsible for that child. But He gave the child to the care of the next step, Rita and AJ. The parents are the next step, father and mother, as the direct parents of the child under God. Grandparents come next because they're the parents of the one who gave them the grandchildren. Right? They come next. It's going to be more understandable as I go. After grandparents, older adults that have influence on the children. That can be members of the congregation, teachers, policemen, right? People that are in authority. It can be siblings or younger adults. I would like for those of you that are teenagers and young adults to look at this and say, fathers, meaning older people in the congregation, don't cause Abigail to grow up in wrath. And we'll talk more about what that means in just a moment. Siblings, young adults, for you teenagers out there, Abigail will look at you as an old person. She will. You are a dinosaur. You're like 15 years older than she is. You are Doug Horchek's grandson saying, you're a 19er. You know, they're going to look back at you and they're going to say, you were born in 2000, you know, whatever, 5? You're ancient. You still use Instagram? You're going to be the old person. And you have an influence over them that you may not think you have. But because you're older, they look up to you and they see things differently. You may think, nah, I'm young and I got to have a fun time. The example that you set is going to be very important. Never underestimate the influence that you have on people younger than you. All right, the next section in this, it says, fathers, don't provoke to wrath your children. Provoke to wrath. That's a single word in the Greek. Paroguzet. Provoke to wrath. Again, this can be a hard section to hear, but I want you to hear it. I'm right there with you. As a grandparent, I understand that this can be kind of a tough thing to hear. This actually means to not provoke to wrath means don't exasperate or enrage a child. It doesn't just mean to be angry. It means don't exacerbate or don't exasperate. That's the word I'm looking for. Exasperate a child. And this can happen in many ways. Your example tells a lot to a child. Your example versus what you say to them. I want to repeat this twice. This is a key concept. Children can see hypocrisy before they can see truth. You understand what that means? A child can see hypocrisy before they can see truth. What does that mean? If you tell them one thing and you do another, they won't understand why, but they will see hypocrisy. What's one of the first words that comes out of a child's mouth? That's not fair, right? And it's because they see things. They see hypocrisy. They can see hypocrisy before they can see truth. They may not understand a command at first, but if they see you model the behavior, they learn to obey, and then they learn why later. I'll give you just a simple example. A child starts to cross the street. They're not looking. Their puppy has run across the street. They just dart out there, and you grab them by the wrist and say, no, you can't do it. You've got to look both ways. Well, if they see you walk up to the road and look both ways, and I actually mean you might just glance real fast, but if you know your kid's watching, really look. Why? You're setting an example for them to say, well, Dad doesn't do it. Or, oh yeah, Dad does that. I don't know why he does that, but okay, if Dad does it, then I guess it's okay. You're setting an example for them to be able to see. Do that with everything in life. I'm going to give several examples in just a minute. If they see you model the behavior, they will obey now and learn why later. As they get old enough to understand, they will. If they see you do the same thing, they will model your behavior. Children are little apists, if you know what I mean. I don't mean gorillas. I mean people that do what they see, right? They will model your behavior. So I want to give some examples here. I want to talk to parents, grandparents, siblings, etc., on how you can do this. Parents, AJ and Rita and all of you that are parents in here that have young children, those of you that may want to become parents soon, just take a listen to this. You should be creating an environment of calm. I'm going to talk a little bit about this word, paragazette, in just a moment. Create an environment of calm. Children have just as much stress as the parents do. Even as infants, they can pick up on your stress. I don't know if you've ever... Your pets can pick up on your stress. Our son's got a pit bull. If you come into the house and you're upset, he is anxious. He can feel it. Kids can pick up on that too. They know when they walk in the house, you may put a smile on your face, but if there is tension in your body, the child will pick up on that. Create an environment of calm. If they come into the house and they see mom and dad fighting, as an example, it adds to their stress. And what happens? What lesson do they learn if they come in to the house and see mom and dad fighting? One of the things they do is they disengage from mom and dad. Now, just personal experience here. I grew up in a house where my parents fought every day. And I would come home from school, and if they were fighting, I either went out to play or I went in my room and I closed the door. I disengaged from my parents because I didn't want to be a part of that. I felt the stress. I don't like stress. I've always been kind of an empathetic person, and I just wanted to be as far away from that as I could. So I disengaged from my mom and dad for years because I didn't want that stress. And then when I reacted angrily for something, because that was the model, right? Something happened, you yell at each other, so something would happen, and I would yell, and I got spanked. How fair? That's not fair. I saw the hypocrisy, right? Before I could understand the truth, I saw the hypocrisy. They would fight and yell and scream at each other, but I couldn't. Right? You need to create an environment of calm so that they don't see that. Grandparents, this applies to you as well. The child knows who the parents are. The child knows AJ and Reader are mommy and daddy. They know that. They know who the grandparents are. Eden is just at the age now, at age 3, where she's starting to recognize grandpa is mommy's dad. Right? It takes a while before, but they eventually see that. They know who their parents are. If the grandparents publicly debase the parents, then the children learn to doubt their parents. Well, grandma thinks mom and dad are wrong, so I think mom and dad are wrong. I don't need to listen to them. Grandma and grandpa don't listen to them. See, to the child, the parent is kind of the center of the universe. And if they see other people griping or carping about them, then they learn to distrust their parents as well. Grandparents don't do that. If you want to talk to your child about something that you don't think they're doing, do it privately. That's the way you do it. You should do that in life anyway, right? If you have a problem with someone, don't get around 20 people and say, I got a problem with you. You know, you shouldn't be doing this. No, you pull them aside privately. That helps a child grow in a calm environment. Siblings. Let's talk about siblings here. Older brothers or sisters, or maybe cousins or aunts or uncles. Same applies to you. If they see you arguing with your parents, they will model that behavior. If Emma and Abigail see, pick out your teenagers in there. If they see you arguing with your parents, they'll learn. Well, that's what the old people do, you teenagers, and they'll pick that up and they'll start to model that. Satan wants that. He wants them to model that behavior. Don't do that. Don't let Abigail and Emma see you argue with your parents, or they will model that behavior. If you argue with them or with each other, they'll pick on that. They'll pick up on that and they'll model that. If they don't have that bad model, they'll never learn it. Now, they'll start to pick it up in school. But by then, you've had 5 years of a stress-free environment, hopefully at home, and they will learn to model the right behavior. On the positive side, I want to talk, I said this earlier, I want to talk about this word paralgizo, which it means, my mind just went blank, provoked to wrath. Para is actually a Greek word that means beside or near, and orgizo means anger. So it's almost like, well, I'm here and I've got this other person beside me that's called anger. And so when something happens and I look over at my friend and say, what should I do? You should get angry. And then blah, you start to yell. That's what that word means. You're with anger. So use the opposite of that. Have the other person next to you, the peaceful person. So something happens and you look over and say, what should I do? And just relax. Just calm yourself. Don't get upset. Don't get your dander up. Kids will pick up on that. Instead of having anger beside you, have peace beside you. There's another Greek word that's almost from the same root as paragizo, and it's the English, if you translate it into English, it's irascible. Do you know what irascible means? Easily provoked. An irascible old man. I don't know if you've ever heard that term or not. It's the type of person that no matter what happens, they're going to get grumpy. You know the type. They're just grumpy. Now, we used to sing a song at the Feast of Tabernacles. You can't be a grump at the Feast of Tabernacles. I don't know if any of you remember that song or not. But it meant something to us where don't let that be the first tool that you grab out of your toolbox. I'm going to be a grump. Right? Don't be irascible. Be peaceful. Next thing, fathers, don't provoke to wrath your children. This word children in Greek, techna, or plural technos, goes way beyond just a parent to a child. I want to read this from Strong's Concordance, what this word means. It is the intimate and reciprocal relationship formed between two people through the bonds of trust, love, friendship. That could be anybody. That could be a friend at school. It could be a sister. It could be an aunt or an uncle. It could be a next-door neighbor. It's the love between two people. If there is a love between, say, an older person and a younger person, there is almost a parent-sibling or child relationship that you can have there. You can have it with a teacher. How many kids just come home and say, I love my teacher? And how many teachers might say, children, you know, I want you to be quiet now. There's a relationship that's formed where the word child, the word techna, can mean more than just, again, parent and child. It can be an intimate relationship. It can be an affectionate address that teachers use. In the New Testament, the disciples are called children. Jesus Christ said, my children. And he meant old men, or middle-aged men anyway. They were his children because he was their instructor and they would listen to him. There was this parent-child relationship that was formed. Then going on, it says that you should bring them up. That word in Greek carries much more meaning than just corrective. Sometimes we read that and it says, we think that it says, don't provoke them to wrath, but bring them up, but use correction, and it means much more than that. Bring them up. Let's look at what this word means. It is the same word that means to nourish until adulthood. It's a very specific word. It doesn't mean you nourish them for the rest of their lives, but you nourish them to adulthood. In other words, you take like a young bird that's in the nest, and before it fledges and goes out on its own, the parent brings nourishment back. You nourish until the time when the kid is now an adult and out on his own. The word here, bring them up, means to take them to adulthood. Think about what God says. Does he say that, parents, you will forever be, thumb over your kid for the rest of the life? No, it says that a person, when they grow up, they get married, they start their own family. They leave mom and dad. They start their own family and they have kids. This word bring up means you take them up to that point where then you transfer them to their own life. You don't keep, you still are a parent, but you don't keep. Now I told you, you know, at some point in time that ends and they go off into adulthood. And as a grandparent, you transition to a different way of working and talking to your kids. You nourish them, you feed them until adulthood. And what do you feed them with? It says here, in the training and admonition. Those are two very specific words, and I want to talk about what each one of those means just very quickly. The word training here means to train someone to reach their full development by giving them moral lessons, right? I talked about this morning. This is like a journeyman and an apprentice. And we don't do that much anymore in the job world, but it used to be that when a young person say he wants to become a carpenter, instead of going to school to be a carpenter, he would go work for a master carpenter, for a journeyman. And the older person would teach the younger person, here's how to do mortise and tenon. Here's how to do this. Here's how to cripple this in. Here's how to put electrical. Here's how to put plumbing. And you would teach the person through moral lessons, through values. So you're not just saying, do it this way. You would maybe let them do it wrong and then say, now see why this doesn't work, and you're teaching them. You're giving them the opportunity to learn. That's what this word teaching means. The word admonition means to warn them through teaching. So you improve their reasoning by helping them see if then. If you do this, then this will happen. But if you do that, then the bad thing will happen. You give them both sides of the coin and then let them choose. And when it goes wrong, you teach why that was right or wrong. If they did right, you praise them for doing right, and it helps them to learn. So you bring them up in the teaching and admonition of the Lord. It's a very specific word that's used here. The word Lord is kurios. They could have used the word theos, meaning God, but that's not the word they used. They're not saying here, bring them up in the training and admonition of God the Father. That's not what they're talking about. The word they're using here is theos, kurios. Kurios can mean Jesus Christ. He often is called Lord in the Bible. But that word also is translated dozens of times, not only in the Bible but in Greek literature, as just anyone that's over someone else, a teacher, a policeman, the older person that lives in the block. Those are all kurios. They're the older ones, the master. The person that is exercising ownership, or the one in charge. You teenagers that babysit, during the time that you babysit, you are the kurios. You are the Lord. That's what that word means. You're the one that's in charge. So this can be the parents. It can be the grandparents. It can be kids. It can be siblings. It can be those of us in church. When we train children, when we train Abigail, when we train Emma, we train them in the nurture and the admonition of authority. We teach them to honor and respect authority. I've said this before, I say it again. I turn the television off when I hear, I don't care what news channel I'm on, if they say Trump or Obama instead of President Trump or Mr. Trump, I turn the TV off. It just irks me to hear people disrespect an office like that. We need to be teaching our children to have respect for authority. To you fathers, I hope this has a different meaning now, all of you, don't provoke your children to wrath. Don't get them to where they're upset. Keep them calm. Bring them up in the training and the admonition to respect authority. That authority can be Jesus Christ. It can be the parents. It can be the grandparents. It can be older siblings. They need to learn proper respect and authority. I actually tried to look this up to see where this came from. You probably have all heard this saying, it takes a village to raise a child. I couldn't find where that came from. The best guess is that it came from somewhere in Africa, because there are several sayings in several different languages over there that, there goes my voice, several different languages over there that have something similar to that. But it does take a village to raise a child. AJ and Rita can't do it alone. They're the primary focus right now, and that's what it should be. We all have a responsibility to raise Abigail. It starts with God. He gave them great parents. They're going to do a fantastic job because they're smart, they're loving, they want their kids to be raised correctly. AJ and Rita will do their best. Their extended family are going to be heavily involved in raising those kids, and they should be, and they're great. They have a great family. That extended family is going to do a lot of things. Cousins, nephews, aunts, you all have a responsibility as well, but so do the rest of us. We all will have influence over baby Abigail. We need to do our best. Let's make sure that we do a good job. AJ and Rita, enjoy her as a child. you're going to turn around and she's going to be driving the car.